That was the key. The $500,000. She had him, and they both knew it. He couldn't afford to pass it by. But he made one last effort. "Is she in charge around here, Capo? Do I take my orders from you or from her?" "That won't work either." Claudia tried to keep her tone placatory, although she longed to tear into him with tooth and nail. That crude sally of his rankled. "My father and I are agreed on this. Both of us go, or we call the deal off. Isn't that right, Papa?"
"I'm afraid that's it, Sean."
Ricardo looked tired and discouraged.
"It's not negotiable. If you want your money, you take Claudia along with us."
Sean turned on his heel and strode away towards his own tent, but after a few paces he stopped and stood with his hands on his hips. Sean's shouts had attracted the camp servants, and they hovered around the mess tent and peered out of the doorway and windows of the kitchen hutments, apprehension mingled with curiosity.
"What the hell are you all gawking at?" Sean roared. "Have you got no work to do around here?"
And they disappeared with alacrity. Sean turned and walked slowly back to where the two of them stood beside the Toyota.
"Okay," he agreed, staring coldly at Claudia. "Cut your own throat, but don't come to me for a bandage."
"I won't. That's a promise." Her voice was honey-dripping, more irksome to him than straightforward gloating would have been, and they both knew that their declared truce was at an end.
"We've got some paperwork to do, Capo."
Sean led the way to the mess tent without looking back at them. With two fingers, Sean typed out the indemnity statements on his old portable Remington, one for Ricardo and one for his daughter. Each began, "I acknowledge that I am fully aware of the danger and the illegality," and then he typed an acknowledgement of debt for Ricardo to sign. Then he typed an acknowledgement of debt for Ricardo to sign, and called Job and the chef to witness the signature. He sealed all the copies in an envelope addressed to Rima at the Harari office and locked it in the small steel safe at the back of the mess tent.
"Let's do it then," he said.
The poaching expedition would consist of the three whites, Job, Matatu, Pamula, and the stocky bearded tracker who had picked up Tukutila's spoor at the river crossing. His name was Dedan.
"It's too many, but each of those tusks weighs 130 pounds, Sean explained.
"Matatu is too small to act as a porter. We need four big men to bring them back." Before the equipment was loaded into the Toyota, Sean ordered it laid out and opened and checked each pack. Claudia protested when he opened her personal pack. "That is an invasion of my privacy."
"So take me to the Supreme Court, ducky," he challenged as he went through it remorselessly, throwing out most of the tubes and bottles of cosmetics, allowing her only three tubes of moisturizer and sunscreen. "One change of underwear," he ordered, discarding half a dozen pairs of panties. "But you'll need two more pairs of thick socks. Get them."
He pulled out her box of Tampax.
"Everything a man can do, and then some," he remarked coldly. "You don't need the box. It takes up too much space. Pack them loose."
Her poorly suppressed fury gave him a sour pleasure. By the time he had finished, they were down to the barest essentials, and the packs were carefully weighed and apportioned, depending on the strength and physical condition of each bearer. Sean, Job, Pumula and Dedan carried 60 pounds each, Ricardo and Matatu 40, while Claudia was down to 25 pounds.
"I can carry more," she protested. "Give me 40, the same as Matatu."
Sean did not bother to answer her.
"And what's more, I eat half as much as any of you."
But he had already turned away to supervise the loading of the Toyota. There were still 4 hours of daylight remaining when they left Chiwewe camp, but Sean drove the first section very fast, jouncing them around in their seats. It was partly an expression of his objection to Claudia's presence, but mostly an urgent desire to be at the jump-off point before nightfall. As he drove, he spoke in a tightly controlled voice.
"Before we commence this guided tour of the Mozambique paradise of the proletariat, this shining gem of African socialism, will you bear with me while I give you a few facts and figures?" Nobody protested, so he went on. Until 1975, Mozambique was a Portuguese colony. For almost 500 years it had been under Portuguese control and had been a reasonably happy and prosperous community of some 15 million souls. The Portuguese, unlike the British or German colonists, had a relaxed attitude towards miscegenation, and the result was a large mulatto population and an official policy of assimilado, under which any person of colour, if he attained certain civilised standards, was considered to be white and enjoyed Portuguese nationality. It all worked very well, as indeed most colonial administrations, especially those of the British. Bullshit, said Claudia demurely. That's limey propaganda. Limey? Sean smiled thinly. Careful, your prejudice is showing. Nonetheless, your average Indian or African living today in a former British colony is a damned sight worse off now than he was then. Certainly that goes 100 times more for your average black man living in Mozambique. At least they're free, Claudia cut in, and Sean laughed. This is freedom, an economy managed under the well-known socialist principles of chaos and ruination, which has resulted in a negative growth rate of up to 10% per annum for every year since the Portuguese withdrawal, a foreign debt amounting to double the gross national product, a total breakdown in the educational system, only 5% of children regularly attending a recognised school, one doctor per 45,000 persons, only one person in 10 with access to purified drinking water, infant mortality at 340 per 1,000 births. The only worst countries in the world are Afghanistan and Angola. But as you say, at least they are free. In America, where everybody eats three huge meals a day, freedom may be a big deal, but in Africa, a full belly counts for a hell of a lot more. It can't be as bad as that, she protested. No, he agreed. It's a lot worse. I haven't mentioned two other factors. The Civil War and AIDS. When the Portuguese were pushed out, they handed over to a dictator named Samora Machel and his Frelimo party. Machel was an avowed Marxist. He didn't believe in this nonsense of elections, and his rule was directly responsible for the present condition of the country and for the emergence of the National Mozambique Resistance, or, as it's known to its friends and admirers, RENAMO. Nobody knows much about it, what its objectives are, who its leaders are. All we know is that it controls most of the country, especially the north, and that it is made up of a pretty ruthless bunch of characters. RENAMO is a South African front organisation, directed, supplied and controlled from Pretoria. Claudia helped him out. Committed to the overthrow of sovereign government and the destabilization of the southern continent. Well done, Ducky, Sean nodded approval. You've been studying the wisdom and erudition of the Organization of African Unity and the Non-Aligned Nations. You've even mastered their jargon. If only South Africa had the military and technological capability to commit half the skullduggery it is accused of, it would be simply the most powerful country in Africa. It would be running the entire world. I keep forgetting you're one of them, which is silly of me. You don't attempt to conceal your bigotry. The simple fact is that your government and apartheid are the scourge and the curse of Africa. Of course, we are responsible for everything. The AIDS epidemic, the famines of Ethiopia and Angola and Mozambique, the breakdown of government in Uganda and Zambia, the corruption in Nigeria and Zaire, it's all a dirty South African plot. We even killed Samora Machel. We fed vodka to the Russian crew of his Tupolev jet and with our incredibly sophisticated technology, lured him over the border. Machel hit one of our racist mountains with such force that his brains and major organs were instantly expelled from his body. Nevertheless, our apartheid doctors kept him alive long enough to torture state secrets out of him. That is the truth as determined by UNO and OAU. Shut up, said Ricardo Montero. I've had enough. Shut up, both of you. Sorry, Sean grinned at him. I'll get carried away. I just wanted to let you know what to expect when we cross the border.
We can just hope that we aren't going to meet any of the lads from either Frelimo or Renamo. There's not a lot to choose between them. They both shoot the same bullets.
The thought made the back of his own neck prickle, and he felt his mood lighten. He was going into mortal danger again, and the thrill of it began. Somehow, having the girl with him no longer irked, but rather heightened that anticipation, and he felt his resentment of her begin to fade. He was glad she was here, rather than jetting back to Alaska. Sean drove on, in a silence that gripped them all, even the men standing braced against the roll bar in the back of the Toyota. The closer they came to the border, the deeper the silence became. At last Sean turned and looked over his shoulder, and Job nodded agreement.
"This is it, ladies and gentlemen," said Sean quietly. "All change."
He let the Toyota trundle to a halt where the track crossed a stony ridge.
"Where are we?" Ricardo asked.
"As close as we can safely get to the border, about 3 miles. From here it's Shanks's pony."
Ricardo swung one leg out of the truck, but Sean said sharply,
"Hold it, Capo. Step into that slab of rock. Leave no tracks."
One at a time, each carrying their own pack, they alighted from the truck, at Sean's instruction, stepping precisely in the footsteps of the person in front. Matatu was the last off, and he came backwards, brushing over the sign with a switch of dried grass, wiping out every trace of their departure from the truck. The chef had come with them to drive the truck back to the camp.
"Go in peace, Mambo," he called to Sean as he pulled away.
"Fat hope," Sean laughed, and sent him off with a wave.
Then to Job, "Anti-tracking, let's go."
Neither Ricardo nor Claudia had ever watched anti-tracking procedure, for while hunting they'd always run free in pursuit. The formation for anti-tracking was Indian file, Job leading and everyone else stepping in his footprints. Behind them all, Matatu, the old maestro, was covering the sign, replacing a pebble lichen side up, stroking a blade of grass into its original position, flicking at the earth with his grass switch, picking up a leaf dislodged from a low-hanging branch or the bruised blade of grass on which a foot had trodden. Job avoided the game paths and soft ground, choosing always the line of march which was most obscure, and yet moving surprisingly fast, so that within half an hour Claudia felt the chill of fresh sweat between her shoulder blades and at the cleavage of her shirt front. Job led them to the top of a low koppie, and Sean motioned them to conceal themselves below the skyline with the sunset behind them. Watching them work, Ricardo remarked softly, "Pumula and Adan seem to know what they're doing." The two of them had moved out to guard the flanks without being ordered to do so.
"Yes," Sean settled down between him and Claudia, using the same low bush for cover. "They were both non-coms in the scouts. They've done this before."
"Why are we stopping here?" Claudia asked.
"We are sitting on the border," Sean explained, "and we'll spend the last of the daylight studying the ground ahead. As soon as the moon comes up, we'll move in. You can relax until then."
He lifted his Zeiss binoculars and stared through them. A few yards away, Job lay on his belly and focused his own pair of binoculars in the same direction. They lowered the binoculars from time to time to blink their vision clear or polish an imaginary speck from the lens. Claudia had noticed how they protected and looked after those most essential tools of their craft. But apart from that, their concentration on the terrain ahead was absolute and ended only when the last gleam of the sunset faded. Then Sean buttoned the binoculars into his top pocket and turned to her.
"Time for your makeup," he said.
For a moment she didn't understand, and then she felt the greasy touch of camouflage cream on her cheek and instinctively pulled away.
"Hold still," he snapped. "Your white face shines like a mirror. It's good for insects and sunburn also."
He daubed her face and backs of her hands.
"Here comes the moon."
Sean finished working on his own camouflage and screwed the top back on the tube of cream.
"We can go in now."
Sean changed the formation once again, putting out flankers, Job and Pumula, while he led the centre, and once again Matatu brought up the rear, diligently sweeping their tracks. Once Sean stopped and checked Claudia's equipment. A loose buckle on her pack had been tapping regularly in time with her stride, a noise so small that she hadn't noticed it.
"You sound like the charge of the light brigade," he breathed in her ear as he adjusted it.
"Arrogant bastard," she thought, and they went on in silence.
An hour, and then another hour, without pausing.